Welcome to the Reasoning with an Optimist podcast for the week of October 4th, 2015. This is Jack Brissett Mills. We have a conversation today with Jim, and it's kind of long, 50 minutes, and I did have to cut it off even then, but it was growing so nicely from nothing at all. It grew into quite a lovely thing, and I didn't want to deprive you of hearing what we had. First, the verses for this week. This one I wrote 2 years ago, verse 27. When I quietly look into my true depths, a feeling of expectation arises, encouraging me to look deeper, as if my true self were there, fully formed, but dormant, awaiting the proper time to send out its new shoots. And then verse 27a I wrote last year, both about the same verse from Rudolf Steiner's Calendar of the Soul for week 27. Verse 27a. When I go deep within, the feeling that I can go further comes over me, as though I will find myself at my very essence, a seed ripened by the summer, and placed in my soul to sprout after its autumn sleep. So here I am with Jim at a little cafe. Thank you, Jim. Enjoy. So I put my first podcast up last night, but it's just an introductory kind of laying out the idea of elevated conversation, that you don't, when you're listening to someone, you're not thinking of the response. You're listening to the person. You're actually listening to them. And then when they're done, you don't just say your point of view. You try to say something that'll help them go up further with what they were just saying. You know, that's a beautiful thing when that happens. It really can be nice. And at the same time, you don't just talk about the weather, and you don't just talk about my neighbor Joe or whatever. You try to raise it up a little bit. So you feel good about it later then. You have an echo of it later in the day. It's not just a dead thing. And you don't just have the same conversation with everyone. You have, if you converse like that, it's not just the same thing everywhere. It's not just, oh, did I tell you all the news? You know, every time you see someone, what's new? That's the main thing they say. And so you tell them what's new, and then the next person you see, you tell them the same what's new. And after a while, it hurts you a little bit. I think it's good to try to just talk about things that are universal. Go ahead.
How did you get to be that way?
So, this little field of study, Rudolf Steiner gave all these lectures and wrote books. And then there are people who take up his ideas, and some of them go to Waldorf schools, and some of them go to biodynamic farms, and I went through the Waldorf track. And when you meet people there who have studied Steiner, you end up having little study groups where people come together to try to read books together. And then you hear that someone has written books on how to converse, and they even call it Goethean conversation, because Goethe wrote a story or two about how conversation can be the most valuable thing on earth, more precious than the gold even, that it can actually be wealth. If you have a great conversation with someone, it's worth more than anything. And so that idea had filtered down into the study groups. And instead of having a study group where everyone's trying to tell you what they think it means or what they read somewhere else, you let the questions linger. Questions are great, but you don't have to answer them right away, and you don't have to know everything, and no lecturing. It just makes it a much nicer environment. It's not just, oh, he's a know-it-all and he's always going to be talking. No, it's open. We're trying to converse here. We're not trying to say what we know and say what we read, because the general tendency is, like I'm doing right now, just going on and on and wanting to hear yourself talk. And many people go into study groups for that purpose, is they just need to talk and need to have people listen to them, and they want to fight someone who's going to disagree. And so that's really tiring after a while. If you're not that kind of person, you don't go very often. You don't go. It's too hard to go out to see that kind of conversation.
That kind of conversation means a lot to me, too. I feel I have a lot to learn. As far as manifesting conversation like that.
Well, just being interested in the other person, that, I mean, for your spouse or for your colleague, that you're, you know, what was that again? I mean, if it looks like you were distracted for a moment. For me, if I'm telling my spouse something, and then they say, oh, look at the bird, I will not bring up the story again. I will make them say, by the way, what were you saying? I will make them do that, because I feel like they interrupted me, and maybe they weren't interested then. And so when they say, look at the bird, I'll go, oh, yeah. And then I'll just move on to something else without saying a word. I won't say a word. And I'll expect my partner to say, oh, yeah, you were talking. What were you saying? I was listening. I just wanted you to see the bird. And I say, oh, good, thanks. And then I'll go back to it. Because I really demand that I'm not boring. I mean, if I am boring, I want them to tell me I'm boring by not listening. And then I can bring it up later and say, by the way, I must have been really boring earlier when you didn't listen to me. And so it ends up being a different conversation. Now you're talking about your relationship, and your partner thinks that you're a bore. And is that my problem or their problem? Right? But anyway, in a partnership, you have to at least pretend that you're listening. And so when you say, look at the bird, you have to remember, oh, wait, I heard them talking. What was that you were saying, honey? You have to at least pretend to be interested, to be a good partner.
I think I've picked that up from you, and I actually felt guilty for changing the subject, and then I was like, no, I don't want to do that, Jack.
When did you change the subject?
I don't know. I think
anyway.
Just like that's a good. Bird flies by. Oh,
that's
look
good.
At that. And
that's
then,
good. As long as you can go back to it, though. But I don't think we're talking about anything at the moment, so.
Yeah.
Except conversation itself.
Well, I think good conversation, the kind that you're talking about, I have had that in the past. Not that I'm able to get that kind of conversation going on, but when I do have conversations like that, I feel like it is worth more than gold. It is really something. There's some sort of an emotional connection happens with conversation like that.
Yeah.
That I think is so important to the human soul.
It's kind of
a
healing.
I don't know what it is.
It's kind of a healing.
Exactly.
And really, it comes out of interest in the other, right? Which is love. I mean, the basis of that is love, that you're actually wanting to be interested in the other person.
I think it really does bring healing. I think it brings, like, if you are able to have conversations like that with lots of people around you, you're probably more at peace. Period. I know I would be.
So it's worth practicing then, if you think that.
Yeah. The problem with me is I don't know how to get conversations like that going yet. I'm not experienced enough.
Well, the starting might be hard, but you're in conversations all the time. I've been your colleague for years. And
mm-hmm. It's easy with you.
But I see you talking with others. So when you're in the mundane, and you're talking about the thing in front of you. Yeah, what does it take to have a relationship? So if you read books, right? You read books. So you've got then in your background all this stuff from the books you've read. And again you find in regular life, you're looking at this mundane thing, but it could make an echo to the thing you read a year ago. I mean, you could bring up, oh, that sounds like, da-da-da.
So-and-so.
some people are good at jokes, so everything can remind them of a joke. But in a way, that is broadening the conversation. It's not just the mundane. It's, did you hear about the two guys? You know, then suddenly it's not just the mundane anymore. It's a little wider. Maybe it's not elevated yet, but it's breaking out a little bit from the step one, step two, step three kind of normal life. I suppose at work it's not so easy because most of us can't work and talk at the same time. So if we're talking, we're not working, and someone is paying us, and that person might see us not working, and so it's hard.
Especially if you're making noise.
Yeah, you can't
talk. How do you talk over a router?
And if you want to talk to the guy who's making noise, they have to stand there with their heavy equipment waiting for you to stop talking. So maybe it's not a practical art, this conversation. Maybe it's only for Sunday afternoons, you know. But it is possible.
Or lunchtime.
Or lunchtime. But it is possible with your spouse on a daily basis.
I feel like conversation like this. I think you and I were going to talk about paranoia. I think it can prevent paranoia from coming up if you're able to have conversations like this.
I was trying to think of the background of paranoia. Of course, genetically, throughout a million years, it has, the person who's been paranoid ends up living, right? And the person who's trusting and happy is killed. And I would think today there are more paranoid people alive than happy, trusting people, right? There's a you have a much more success rate as an organism if you're paranoid. So naturally, you have a large amount of that. So do I, because that's how we survive. We look out and we assume, because that way no one's going to get us. But probably a lot of that paranoia, which was legitimate when people were actually killing each other every day. Look at us. We have this whole lifetime, you and I, not a war around us our whole life. I missed the Vietnam draft by a couple years. You haven't had any draft. That's a different question, of course. Now, we've been at war as a country for the whole time I've been alive, but they're not randomly forcing me to go.
Yeah, I've never seen violence associated with war here in Texas.
It's the result of our border policy and our I guess it's even racist. Our laws that keep things the way they are. You know, we have really violent borders in order to allow you and me to have this nice Sunday chat year after year, never having anybody invading us, is the result of a violence that we don't see. It's all around us, and we pay for it. We send our money to support it because we love this easy life we got.
Yeah.
I don't know what you could say about paranoia that everyone already doesn't know. Everybody knows it. Everybody has it.
Yeah.
You've actually done some group work with it. You've talked to people about it. I mean, professionals. You've talked to people who, I mean, I guess you can study paranoia. You can study it in groups of people. And I don't know that there's any rules, though, written down where, well, first you do this. And then, I mean, there's no science, really, with anything psychological. It's all an art, right? And if you meet this therapist, they're good with you. They're not any good with me. But then that other therapist is good with me, but you hate them somehow. There's no art, there's no science to therapy, right? There's no, this is what you do. When you meet someone who's paranoid, you do this, and then they're not paranoid anymore. It's totally an art, right? And it's up to you to fix it. They can give you suggestions. Is that true? I don't know.
Well, as far as my experience, I saw several therapists, and Like, the first one was just based on cognitive, like, trying to outthink it. But paranoia is an emotional
state.
State. And there, I just never felt like there was any way that the cognitive approach would do anything for relieving the paranoia. Then there was the group therapist. He worked on building connections in conversation with like 8 to 10 people in the room, and just being there with a human being and really realizing, I don't know, it was those connections that helped. It wasn't anything else. And, you know, little by little, the more connections I had, the more the paranoia just kind of disappeared without me even doing anything. It was like, it's almost like I didn't learn anything. It was so unnoticeable, except for the connection thing. I think that's the main take home for me.
As an outsider hearing that, I would say maybe your psyche got proof that everyone wasn't out to get you. You had a group of 8 people and none of them were out to get you, whatever.
Yeah.
And so you had experience. You actually got experience that if you just talk with people, you realize that they're paranoid too. Everybody's paranoid. Maybe, right? You start to realize mm-hmm. the universality of it.
Yeah, you feel like, well, everybody feels the same way I do, so then you start to feel better.
That's wonderful. We have a strong feeling of being alone and being odd and being a misfit, don't we? And so just having the realization, teenagers, every single teenager thinks they're the only one who ever felt this way, and they're all alone.
It kind of reminds me of when I was training to become a diver, they taught us some safety stuff where if someone was in trouble and they were freaking out either underwater 100 feet down or at the top, one thing that you do is you look them in the eye. You grab
nice.
Them and you look them in the eye.
Nice.
And that lets them know that you are right there with
nice.
Them.
Nice. Because their animal brain is in full control at that moment. And so you show them a human being.
Yeah.
Very cool.
But it was like that grabbing gesture and like, yeah. I'm right here with
yeah.
you,
yes.
you know.
Yes.
And even gesture with your 2 fingers,
yeah.
eye contact.
Very cool.
But I think we did that in group too.
Yeah.
The guy in charge just said, why don't you turn to the person next to you and look them in the
Take
eye.
Take a look.
And tell me how that feels.
Nice. I mean, that's the entirety of therapy is right there. That seems like that. What could you do better than that? That is, I mean, drugs, of course. If you say something is emotional, right away you think, oh, okay, drugs will fix that, right? Because today everything emotional is
yeah.
related to a drug.
Well, I think all that does is just numb your brain so you don't,
yeah.
kind of like that THX 2339 movie
oh, yeah,
or whatever
yeah,
it was.
Right. Everyone is required to be drugged
mm-hmm.
at all times. Nice bell sound.
Yeah.
For the longest time, I thought that bell was a big speaker with a recording of a bell, but I think it's actually a bell.
Yeah, it sounds like a bell to me.
I was trying to pick out some emotion that I have on a regular basis that is totally normal for me, right? Well, I don't know what it even say. So, boredom, I don't know what. Just pick anything you want. Some normal daily emotion that I have that is totally normal. But then suddenly I'm going to tell myself, you got to stop doing that. What would I possibly do to stop having that emotion? You know, what could I possibly do? Or is it more a question of not that you shouldn't have the emotion, because then you, well, everyone has that, you got to have it. It's how you react to it and how you spin it. That's the problem. It's not the emotion. Does that hit anything with what you're talking about? Do they focus on this or do they focus on that? Or do they not even go there? Or what do you do?
That, to me, I think we did talk about that a little bit. One thing you don't want to do is stuff it, is what I like to call that, where you just deny that emotion ever happened. Or try to not feel... Like, I'm reading this book right now about this guy who lost his wife and daughter, and he's feeling horrible about it, and he talks about the only thing that helps him to feel better or get his brain out of that dangerous place is to just go hiking or go ride his motorcycle. But to me, that is a form of escapism. But, you know, that might have been okay for him in that moment because he was feeling such huge, crazy emotions that he needed to get away. Otherwise, he might have killed himself or something. But, like, for someone who's not dealing with huge issues like that, you know, day to day, just trying to cope with yourself and those voices upstairs. Man, I don't know. I don't know what to do as far as validating that voice so it calms down.
Because you do have the original feeling is there. Suddenly you have the feeling, whatever it is, boredom or paranoia. If it's serious enough that you're going to collapse or kill yourself, maybe it is smart to go take a ride on the motorbike.
Yeah.
And time can pass.
And you see stuff moving by, trees and birds.
And time is the cure for especially loss. Maybe not depression itself, because depression might go with you forever, but the loss... Most people, after a year or two, they're able to look at the world without every single place you go thinking, I remember this place with them. You know, loss, you can get over that. You do remember every single place with them, but it doesn't hurt anymore as the same way it does. Maybe you start to feel a joy that you were there with them. So time does work with loss, but I don't know if it does with depression. I have a strong feeling about depression. I'm totally susceptible to it. And so my own cure is physical activity, walking, chopping wood, dishwashing. Anything that I can do physically, suddenly I feel my life is okay again. And so that's not putting it away. I don't think that's putting it away. I don't think that's ignoring it. That's actually, since my depression doesn't have a reason, I'm not able, I look through and I say, what's wrong with me? How come I'm depressed? I can't find the damn reason, except that I'm just, maybe I don't love myself, you know, or something. And so if I walk or work, I can have a little love of myself again.
Doing something for yourself.
Yeah, but I don't know how that would work with other emotions, paranoia or boredom or... But boredom, for sure, you do something. Boredom is a real sin, I think, that... sin, what is sin? But you're hurting yourself with boredom. And it's your own damn fault, because it means you're not interested enough to do something, right? Or to think something. If you can't get up, if you're paralyzed and you're bored... I mean, there's people who have invented whole fields of geometry and algebra in their jail cell somewhere. They're not allowed anything but thinking. Thinking is all they can do. And they somehow invent a new universe. So what are the tactics that you've come up with? I just told you mine for depression. What do you do for paranoia? Do you walk away? Do you scream? You know, what do you do?
Well,
I mean, screaming is socially unacceptable.
I've tried that, and I think you get more mad, yeah. You know, in the car. Someone who, quote unquote, has windshield rants, you know, but I don't know, that might add fuel to the fire. And,
yeah.
But for paranoia, I think just human connection. That's the only one that I know of that'll work, but I'm trying to explore other options. Like, one time my wife told me, well, if you've got those circular thoughts and they're taking over, then just go for a walk. And I didn't know what else to do, so it's 11 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
I guess I'll go for a walk. So I did, and halfway through the walk, things started to calm down upstairs. And
nice.
And I thought, well, is this escapism or is this actually helping? But, well, if it's circular thoughts, then you probably don't want to keep exploring it because they're just going to keep going in the circle and taking control of things upstairs. So I guess from that standpoint, taking a walk is the most healthy thing. Or maybe yoga or Tai Chi, or I'm kind of curious about either of those too.
I know that there are triggers to circular thoughts. When I played chess at a club, I couldn't sleep after losing. I'd come home and I'd go to bed thinking nothing about chess, but then in the bed, just as I'm about to sleep, I see a vision of a queen or a knight that is about to kill me. The knight that did kill me, or the queen that did kill me, or the knight that I failed to put in the right place somehow will loom just as a momentary flash of a picture of the knight or the queen. And suddenly the trigger and all these chemicals flood through my body and I'm fully awake and paranoid or whatever about that damn queen that is going to kill me. And I, for my sanity, I stopped going to chess because I was not able to say, don't think of the queen. You're falling asleep. You suddenly, there she is. Boom, and you're awake.
And you can't go to sleep because it's consumed you.
Yeah. And so my solution there, well, don't go to chess anymore. I really wanted to get over that. I liked going to chess, but I could not sleep afterward unless I won. If I won, it would be okay. I could sleep. But you lose half the time. No matter where you are in chess, you lose half the time. So every other week, I wouldn't be able to sleep. And I would think that's the closest thing I have to paranoia, because there she is. Oh. But with humans, you can't avoid it. I can avoid the chessboard and I can avoid the game. So avoidance does work in my case. But you can't avoid it if it's a colleague. If it's a colleague, and damn it, I know they don't like me. I know it. What's the way around that? And is it simply the don't like? Is that all we're talking about? Or is it they are sending letters to my boss, or they're tapping into my bank account, or they're putting water in my gas tank? You know, is it ever to that level? I mean, we don't live in a war zone, so it's probably not that level, right? They're not actually poisoning your dog while you're at work.
Man, you would have to be around them for a long time for the paranoia to get to that level, I think. Or things have to be really extreme. But the thing that breeds paranoia, I think, is just little disagreements over and over. It's almost like little losses. Like the queen.
I love that, little losses. Like, over time.
Yeah, like little ones that you don't even notice, or little disagreements, or like
nice hat.
Yeah.
And then 2 days later they'll say something else, and then you'll remember they were making fun of my hat too, and then you start to add them up, right?
Yeah, it's just like this this voice in your head that just suggests well, it would make sense that they would say X because of, I don't know.
Yeah.
And so, like, somehow you, what's the word for it? You rationalize what they did must have meant.
Yeah.
This.
And it actually might have meant that. That's where I go. I totally say, well, what if they did mean it? Because I always want to go through the door.
That is a little loss.
Say it again.
So, yeah, I think you are understanding what I said. But, like, rationalizing in your own head, well, that must have meant that they didn't like what I
yes.
did or how I performed or whatever. And it makes sense because...
Yes.
And then you rationalize it with some sort of thing to back it up.
Yes.
That does make sense.
Yes. And so I was just jumping in and saying, if I was in that position, I would say, well, then what if? And so I would go, yes, they are attacking me. I don't want to fight the truth. You know, I don't want to pretend they're not attacking me. I want to totally admit, okay, they're attacking me. And then I want to turn it on myself. I'm not going to... Am I going to fight them? That's the third... Am I going to fight back? Am I going to quit? I want to make my own self be the action and not wondering, do they mean it? Are they attacking me? I want to totally go through the door and say, yes, they're attacking me. And then make it be my choice. What happens now? Do you feel that, or do you try to resist the jumping to that? Because that's... You try to resist that jumping through the door and saying, no, it's probably not. They're probably not, because I've been wrong so many times.
I feel like since I'm prone for paranoia, I resist that jump.
Okay.
I try and... But the really scary thing is it's this damn paranoia. So you resist, and then the next day you go there. You won the last day, but then something else happens, yeah. And it's the same little, yeah. A little loss.
And it adds to yesterday. You start to doubt yesterday. You don't just erase it yesterday. It comes back.
And this happens over and over and over until finally you're like, he tried to put water in my gas tank.
Yeah, there you go. I was saying, now, since I'm not as prone to it, I would say... Yes, he is intentionally doing that. And so either I can then say, the poor guy, I can have sympathy for him because he's wasting his life trying to attack other people. It's not just me. If he's attacking me, he must be doing that in a regular sense. The poor guy. I would then turn it around and try to have, you know, it's hard to have sympathy for people who are attacking you. But what a waste of a life that they're criticizing my hat, and you know that's a really pitiful life, and so the poor guy.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I would tend to try to do, I would think, but I'm not in that situation.
That's something I need a lot of work on.
Empathy and
sympathy.
How would it work? You have to have be stable, right, to be able to say the poor guy.
But if you're doubting yourself
because
of the paranoia and you're trying to second guess because you want to make the most accurate decision and you don't want to ostracize somebody, then it's almost impossible to be in the right state of mind to be able to do something like that.
And if it's a bad haircut, everyone says something, or at least they look, you know.
Check out that mullet over
but
there.
Then what is... I mean, teenagers, again, that's just their constant every day. Someone is going to look at the difference on them and will not be happy about it. Whatever it is that's different is not good. And so how do you ever make it through as a teenager? The coolest ones from my youth were the ones that didn't care, and they had long hair when everybody else had short hair, and they had baggy clothes when everybody had tight clothes. Those are the cool people. But at the time, they went through their abuse period, and then they just kept being that way, and people just gave up abusing them after a while. And they ended up really being the cool people in college or after. you didn't hang around them in high school because they were just too cool. You didn't realize they were cool. The cool people were the ones that everyone pictured them exactly as they were, you know, strong and neat.
Maybe that makes me pretty cool then.
Have you done these practices? I mentioned them before to you at the end of the day, looking over your day from a distance. That you look at if you stub your toe during the day and someone saw you and they laughed, if you saw that as an outsider from someone else, it wouldn't make a blip on your screen, right? It happens all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody stubbed their toe and somebody laughed. From a distance, it's nothing. If you can look at yourself that way, at the end of the day, try to find the things that happened that were big at the moment. But then, at the end of the day, you look back, maybe even reverse. You look at the day in reverse just to do something different, just to get yourself out of it a little bit. You start it, I just sat down to bed, then I brushed my teeth. You go backwards. And you find the places that were a big deal, and you realize, morning. You realize that, you know, really, it's only a big deal because I was in it. It's not a big deal. That's a good practice. I think it's good for thinking and it's good for emotion. I didn't invent it. Someone else invented it. It's a good practice.
I need to develop that more. I have sat down at the end of the day in this real nice, comfortable chair and just sat there really quiet. And most of the time, I'll just replay the most emotionally impactful point of the day. And maybe I'm going about it in an unhealthy way because I'm trying to justify myself. Yeah. But maybe it's totally not what you're talking about.
Yeah, to be in it again, I don't think that would be good at the end of the day because you're trying to get ready for bed anyway.
Yeah. So it'd be like the Queen situation before you're going.
But somehow to go back, I mean, to step back as an observer, you're not there, you're on the mountaintop looking down at the guy down there on the field. And it's a totally different thing than if you're the guy on the field. It's totally different if you're up on the mountain looking down. He has to really do some amazing stuff to make an impression when you're a mile away.
So looking at it from a total bystander's perspective,
would this affect anybody else if they saw this or if they heard this? Does it affect the world?
They wouldn't think anything of it. For all the stuff that I'm thinking about right now, if somebody else saw that stuff, they'd think, oh, whatever. Yeah. It wouldn't even be... It
happens all the time.
That's interesting.
And so I'm wondering if we do have repeated lives. I always try to think of the big picture, right? If we do have repeated lives and we're outside of this one shell and we see all our lives, today's little blow up, what will that really affect when I'm standing there and I'm getting ready for the next life and I got these 28 lives that I just lived? How will that little thing today affect me in my future development compared to, you know, that's the big picture, right? And so I think that's exactly what you're doing when you imagine yourself stepping away, because when we do have this afterlife experience, we're only talking the big picture. Did I actually change myself anywhere today? Was I different? Did I improve at all? Probably not, right? So the little thing we did together with that one guy, that didn't change us at all. We're totally the same. And so when we look at it from a distance, we go, that's nothing. Of course, if the opposite thing happens and we suddenly love somebody, we suddenly love the guy or we have sympathy for him, I think that's a big deal. And we see from a distance a little red light or a green light, a purple light, saying, hey, there's a difference here. Something good happened.
Yeah. To have enough sympathy or empathy to where you go from that state of paranoia or hate to love, I think I see little glimmers of that from time to time, and that's huge.
Maybe that's the thing. How can we learn sympathy or empathy, has anyone ever taught us how to do that? Do we know instinctively how to do that?
Probably not. I think what you were talking about, looking at it from a distance like you were a bystander, if you were that person and you took notice of what was going on and you could empathize, I don't know if that's making any sense. But I guess basically what I'm saying is the person that is paranoid, if they can take themselves out of the equation and look at it like you're saying, I think the cicada thought that that might have been another cicada.
That's a mating call. I'm not willing to drop that right yet, so back up. What has anyone ever taught us how to have sympathy or empathy? Is it instinctive? Do we know how to do it, and we just don't do it? That seems kind of important, right? We just stumbled upon this idea. So how do you do that? Do you have to have a Bible behind you? Do you have to have a Quran? Do you have to be religious?
I think it's purely emotional. You need to be able to put yourself in their shoes. But something tells me there's something more to that than just putting yourself in their shoes. But maybe it is that simple.
I just heard this great section from the Brothers Karamazov. I'm hearing it on audiobook. And the idea that when you... This religious guy was speaking at his last day. He was giving his wisdom before he died. When you are in judgment over someone, if you are in front of someone who's a criminal, you should take on the responsibility for his crime. You should actually expand that to be you yourself are responsible for all crime on the whole earth. You are responsible for all of humanity's sins. Of course, what that is, that's an imitation of Christ, right? And there's been a great book written about that. But this guy was taking that as, that's what he does. And so how can you judge anyone? I mean, you and I, what we're talking about with paranoia is we are actually judging people, right? We're not taking, if we were accepting of others, we would say, you're right, this hat sucks. I can't pick a good hat. Every time I buy a hat, it sucks. You know, the problem with us is that we resist. We resist the criticism. We go, what right do you have? Right? We're somehow trying to be equal or superior. We don't want to be inferior. We want to at least be equal. But this religious man was saying we are responsible for every sin. I love that idea. I can't do it, but I love that idea. And maybe that's where sympathy can come from. Just not feeling that we are superior to anything. Is that that might be a rotten thing to go about. Maybe you really have to.
I think you're onto something there. I think that is really...
how to do it, of course.
I guess whenever I'm in my car driving around, it's so easy to create a emotional model of driving because everybody does it and they understand how it feels to get cut off or whatever.
Yes.
But, like, it's easy to get pissed off when somebody does wrong to you when you're driving. But if you're able to empathize, you're just saying, well, that person's mad or having a bad day or they're in a hurry, then suddenly you're like backing off of them and letting them go, and you're not getting angry. Or but if you can do that in real life, well, that is a form of empathy.
It's funny how driving is like a little play, right? It's our modern drama. Every day we enter this drama. We are totally different in cars as people. our true selves really come out. The cute little women, when you see them walk by, they are powerful, aggressive beasts in their SUVs. You know, it's just so different out there.
It reminds me of that cartoon with Goofy. And it, I guess it was set in the 1950s, and he's like this, there's this narrator, and he's walking out of his house in the morning to go to work, and there's this little fly on his sidewalk, and the narrator says, this guy wouldn't even hurt a fly, and he holds his hat with both hands in front of him and steps around the fly, and it's like really timid and really sweet looking, and then the narrator, like, once he gets in his car and he starts the engine, then he starts revving the engine over and over, and you can see like these fangs growing out of his mouth, and then like he takes on this totally different persona
already.
Like,
in the 50s that was obvious, huh?
Yeah, cars really do make a big difference, and
it's a marvelous place to practice then whatever we're talking about. To, you could say, okay, this is my little stage, this is my play.
Yeah,
I've been doing that. I've totally forgot that I do it now, but when I get in the car, I don't turn on the radio, and I try to say, this is a special time. This is my special time. Whatever, however you want to put it, that sounds pretty corny, but you could make it, this is my time, and really treat it as a special time. I don't know how to say that any differently.
Sort of meditative kind of. You're still concentrating on driving, but I get it.
And maybe concentrating on being fully involved. You know, we can't really be paranoid if we're actually fully involved with what we're doing, right? And paranoid isn't really, what I mean by paranoid is angry. For me, the reaction to paranoia is anger.
Yeah.
Is a defense. And for me, defense is violence, in a way. It may not be physical, but it's violence. I'm going to resist your attempt to make me less than you. My arms are up, you know, I'm defending. And so in driving, that's of course dangerous, but it's also typical. I mean, people, if you cut in front of someone, they are going to be mad, and they're going to go around you, and they're going to do something to you. To just not be part of it, to not enter in. They will continue looking for someone to fight. They're actually looking for someone to fight. And if it's not you, they're going to, they don't care about you any longer. They're going to get to the next person to fight them. Their main goal is to get someone to fight them. That's how I picture it anyway. And I don't have to do that. But the anger just, I mean, there's an addiction to anger like there's an addiction to anything. And when you're in a car, I've seen so many times people loving being angry. They just love to curse, and they love that bastard. And you do not have to do that. It's not required. It's not at all required.
I wonder why it's such an addictive behavior.
It must be fun, though.
Yeah.
We talked about that. If that was wild animals that were trying to navigate around, we would not be angry at them. They're doing exactly what they're supposed to do. They're trying to get us. And our job is to avoid them. Somehow we put it on others that, oh, they don't have to be that way. Right? That's the problem. It's not that we're just avoiding wild animals that are trying to hurt us. That's really what we could think. We think rather, oh, they're being mean. Yeah?
I was kind of thinking, in these cars that we have now, they're fully insulated and the windows are tinted and you can't see the person in that next car. So therefore, human connection is almost completely cut off. And I think in the old days when you were driving a horse carriage, you weren't insulated, you weren't inside this little bubble. You could actually see and talk to the person over there on the road, and maybe you knew them, and you would give them love and respect.
Yep, yep.
But it's almost interesting you take that connection out of the picture when you're driving, and then suddenly it's this inanimate object, and you're at war with them.
You mentioned the eye contact. You can't have eye contact in cars. I've tried. You can't really do it.
Yeah.
Hey. Church time.
Empathy and sympathy. I think we're having church right now.
I know that for love, you have to have interest. And I suppose empathy and sympathy are in the realm of love, in the realm of interest in the other person. If we go by a dog that's suffering, we don't notice it unless we are interested in dogs, or at least animals. There are people suffering everywhere. And we, if we were clairvoyant, we could tell right away, oh, they lost their husband.
Yeah. And or they're secretly fighting depression or paranoia, or they're hiding it.
And they got a cancer screening tomorrow because the doctor found a lump, you know.
Yeah.
You don't know. And so you can add that fictitious thing. We're not clairvoyant, but we can... I kind of think that clairvoyance comes if you practice imagining that there is a clairvoyance. If you imagine that you can tell, I think that's a way toward it. Or it's a way toward delusion, I don't know. I think if you also have a solid rationality behind you, that practicing imagining is a really good balance. You and I both have a real solid rational side.
Too solid.
I think we could both benefit from imaginative practice. And then if we actually knew that that person was suffering, how could we possibly be mad at them?
Yeah.
So maybe that's a practice of imagination added to reality could help us with a sympathy.
Man, if I know somebody's suffering, it makes me want to go give them a hug.
Yeah.
Even if they're a stranger.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Or just say, let them by. They're in a hurry. Let them go.
Yeah.
On the road, we say, I'm just as much of a hurry as you are. You know, we want to be equal.
Yeah. But well, there's that pride thing.
Yeah. Do you resist ranking? I've never liked superior, inferior. I want to get rid of that altogether. I want to be equal to everybody. So that's why I'm not in a bureaucracy. I'm not in a government. I'm not in an army.
I totally agree. Human beings are human beings, and we all have feelings. And I think you know, instead of being treated like a robot inside your little bubble or car or whatever, I think that would mean a lot to a lot of people.
Well, I felt that was a pretty tender conversation. I didn't really want to stop it. I hope you didn't mind it being 50 minutes long. But what a sweet fellow. Thank you, Jim. There was more to that conversation I might put up some other time, a different subject. Thank you for listening. Comments, questions, please go to reasoningwithanoptimist.net. This is Jack Brissett-Mills. Thanks, and tune in next week. Bye-bye.